From Colorado Public Radio, this is Showcase. I'm Dave Fender. At 10 a.m. on Monday, September 6, 2010, Labor Day, a wildfire started in Four Mile Canyon west of Boulder. Over the course of 11 days, the fire consumed over 6,000 acres of land and destroyed 169 homes. It was the most expensive wildfire in Colorado history, costing around $10 million to fight and causing well over $200 million in property damage. But those numbers only begin to describe the cost of the fire to the residents of the area, those who lost their homes and those whose homes were spared. Then there's the firefighters who responded to the blaze, volunteers who provided shelter and supplies, and decision makers who set policies for dealing with fire. Last month, a group of those people gathered for an event at the University of Colorado Boulder. Each year, the Center of the American West puts on Words to Stir the Soul and Reckon with Reality, and they invite a group of speakers from the community to select a reading that reflects on some aspect of the topic chosen for the evening. This year, that topic was the six-month anniversary of the Four Mile Canyon fire. In this next hour, we'll hear some of the highlights from that evening. Each speaker will introduce themselves and tell their role in the fire. We'll start with the introductory comments given by Patty Limerick. She's a history professor at the University of Colorado and chair of the board of the Center of the American West.
On the morning of Labor Day 2010, I was in my house working on a writing project and noticing in an almost subliminal sort of way that a mysterious, strangely colored cloud was taking over the sky. When I came to full attention, my husband, my stepchildren, and I went outside and looked at the sky and tried to hope for a quick resolution. As we looked at the smoke and observed the wind, I did not burden my companions with historical reflections. In truth, if I have an area of expertise when it comes to reckoning with the impacts of the Four Mile Canyon fire, it is derived more from my experience as a widow than my experiences as a Western historian. With my first husband's death from a stroke in February of 2005, I entered an immersion course on the subject of irreversible loss. I know about the way in which your mind becomes unmanageable and keeps delivering up plans and strategies for reversing time and arranging for a different outcome. I know about the way in which you repeat to yourself, "This is the situation I have now, and this is what I must live with," while your unruly mind still works away at getting the reality you cannot bear to relent and to surrender and to disappear. In preparing for this event and in talking to people who had lost their homes, I found my bearings much more from what I know about widowhood than what I know about the role of fire in Western history. I will, however, make this brief statement about the big pattern of history at work in these matters. In the wildlands-urban interface, two facts coexist and sometimes collide. First, Western forests are places of great beauty, and thus they are attractive places to live. Second, as ecosystems and landscapes, Western forests are subject to episodic fire. For years and even decades, these two facts can coexist without friction or trouble. But at some point, in many Western places, they will collide, and the collision will produce misery and irreversible loss, and also heroism and determination and dedication to community. And asking for a difficult and strenuous reckoning, there will be a conundrum of what lessons should be learned and what actions should be taken. The Center of the American West uses the slogan, "Transforming Hindsight into Foresight." We hope that the event tonight will generate ideas about how we should, or if we should, join others in trying to apply this slogan to the Four Mile Canyon fire. The emphasis of tonight's event is not the formulation of policy for the future, though that may come up in some presentations. We have asked a range of people who were significantly involved and affected by the fire to read from works that gave them perspective and sometimes encouragement in tough times. In an age when floods of information are constantly bearing down on us, it is easy for attention to waver and for memory to fade. For the people reading tonight, and for many in the room, there has been no wavering of attention and no fading of memory on the subject of the Four Mile fire. But for others, other concerns have taken center stage, and the lasting impacts of that fire have moved to the edge of their attention. The largest goal of this evening's program is to bring attention back to the fire and to its long-term meanings. A few days after Labor Day, the prediction was for intense winds starting in the early evening. It was a very precarious situation with the zone of pending evacuations now right in the city. It was a quiet afternoon, and I started to think that maybe the weather predictions were going to turn out to be wrong. And then around 5:30 or 6 o'clock that evening, the wind started up. My neighbor has wind chimes, to which I had never paid an ounce of attention. But that evening, as the winds kicked in, the sound of those wind chimes was the sound of anxiety and distress and intense concern. In the night, when the sound died down, the silence was itself a wonderful thing to hear. But my neighbor's chimes now have an association in my mind that is undiminished. When the wind gets them going, they sound ominous, in a strange way more disturbing than a siren. I remember a time when wind chimes carried no meaning, but I also appreciate the fact that my neighbor's chimes do not let my attention waver, nor do they let my memory of the fire fade. We reaffirm the commitment held by everyone in the room to talk and think about this difficult subject in a spirit of civility and understanding. And in that spirit, I conclude with a remark about Gilbert White, who taught at CU and who set the highest standards for thinking hard about the hazards of life on this planet and about the complicated relationship between human decisions and natural disasters. Gilbert White was a geographer, a Quaker, the founder of the Hazard Center on this campus, and a world-renowned expert on how humans can make choices that will reduce the chances of their deaths from floods. Near the end of Gilbert's life, whenever I saw him, I was overwhelmed with the recognition that this was a man who had saved more human lives than anyone else I had ever met or ever imagined meeting. I've spent the last couple of weeks wishing that Gilbert White could be here tonight and could provide these opening remarks. The closest I can get to this wish is to tell you what Gilbert told me when I asked about the origins of his commitment to helping humanity. He said that whenever he saw his grandmother, beginning when he was really just a toddler, his grandmother would say to him, "Gilbert, what have you done today to make the world a better place?" It is our hope tonight that Gilbert White and his grandmother would approve of what we do here together. Thank you.
My name is Marisha Evans. I'm a freshman at Boulder High School. My family and I lost our house in the Four Mile Fire. This was the house that I was born in and lived in for 15 years. So I wrote this poem to commemorate it. It is titled, Home. Home was peacefulness, happiness, patience. Home was the comfort of my mother's arms, the sonorous resonance of my father's voice, the vibrant melodies of my brother's cello as I fell asleep. Home was the familiar smell of home cooking. Home was my mother's baking, roasting, frying, the glorious result of her hard work. Home was my father's fresh greens that filled the stomach of our happiness. Home was the laughter and the family at all the holidays. Home was old traditions shared with new friends, sharing, giving, receiving. Our greatest reward was seeing a thankful face. Home was souvenirs and old family heirlooms, the rows on rows of much-loved books. Home was the first flowers of spring, the sweet smell filling our house, the elderberry bush whose first fruit was taken by the birds. Home was the prickly pine needles beneath my bare feet, running wild through the tall trees of the mountains. Freedom like the wind. Home was the smell of sticky pine sap on my fingers, the feel of the garden dirt between my toes. Home was digging tunnels through the deep snow, sipping cocoa by the fire on cold winter nights, reading by candlelight when the electricity failed. Home was comfort, family, freedom. The wind changed. The fire burned. I watched the smoke rise into the sky like a giant tree. No familiar smell of pine filled my nose. The air reeked of smoke. White ash fell from the sky like the snow from my memories. There was no escape from the smoke that followed me like a dark cloud. Fear gripped my heart. Home was gone without a second glance. Old memories coating my shoe in white ash. Pictures of my youth taken by the wind. Thank you very much.
Dang, Marisha, that was pretty good. When I was at Boulder High School, I still remember a poem I wrote. Would you like to hear it? I have a little sister. Her name is Nancy Kay. She cannot run or play, but I have fun with her anyway. The end. I got a D. Good to see you, folks. I'm Doug Looney. I stood on the deck of our home at 7,300 feet up Sunshine Canyon and watched the fire inch closer. That was till I discovered it wasn't inching, it was roaring. There were explosions echoing through those mountains. Smoke was choking. Even though I only have an undergraduate degree from CU, I figured out it was time to make our exit. But Marianne, the current wife, we still had hope. Hope often is the last refuge of the hopeless, isn't it? We walked out of the house of our dreams. I didn't lock the door. And we didn't speak. We had hope, but in our souls, we knew. A few months later, I wrote a short note to friends to let them know what had happened. I know you'll forgive me and my larger-than-life ego when I tell you perhaps the most comfort I got was in writing this short piece. I liked it a lot better before I heard Marisha. Inarguably, the most famous quote ever by an American politician, the late President Harry S. Truman, he said, "If you can't stand the heat, then don't station your ass next to the fire in the kitchen or anywhere else because it could set your skivvies ablaze." Old Harry knew whereof he spoke. Indeed, 2010 for us was a cacophony of, everything. But it was a cacophony that lit up the skies over our beautiful Rocky Mountain home west of Boulder. Unfortunately, the fuel for that spectacular blaze was our house. It set our skivvies ablaze and everything else. In this Labor Day fire in Four Mile Canyon and then up in our canyon in Sunshine, you all know by now the numbers engraved in our hearts and souls, and then 169 structures were burned. For all of you who are blonde, here's a description of how our house went. Poof. Marianne and I fled the roaring flames with the clothes we were wearing. Fortunately, I happened to be wearing 7 Brooks Brothers suits at the time. We got out there with a few computers, a few pictures. Saddest was that Marianne, who does a lot of genealogy, lost almost all of her genealogy stuff, including scrapbooks dating to the 1880s. Within a couple hours, the house was smoldering rubble. It was simply all gone. It was simply the perfect storm. The land was parched. The wind was blowing 60 to 80 miles an hour, which prevented the slurry bombers from flying for quite a while. There was little water available in the mountain terrain. It was an unchecked, white-hot inferno of stunning power and sweep. Happily, after I'd only driven a mile or so fleeing the smoke and the chaos, I had a revelation. I immediately turned around, went back to the house, and picked up Marianne. She was not as grateful as I'd anticipated. Sort of reminded me that if you were to lock your wife and your dog in the trunk of your car, which one do you think would be happy to see you when you let them out? But you know what? The fire was fair, really. After all, we were living in a place not meant for humans. Rather, it was created as a home for deer, bear, mountain lions, ponderosa pine, and then served double duty by giving up gold and silver, which developed the West. We were interlopers in an environment of soaring splendor and riches. We were perfectly aware of the risk. We did not go into mountain living with our eyes wide shut. We did not kid ourselves. We lived in this home for 7 years, another one in a nearby canyon for 5 more years. Just think, we got to live 12 years in places that took our breath away daily. A sign in my office read, "If you're lucky enough to live in the mountains, you're lucky enough." Absolutely. Yet we're not going back. It's partly because we're concerned about real estate values. It's partly because we're concerned the good sheriff will just let another one of our houses burn down. It's partly because every day in the future, we would have a reminder of that terrible day in the past. The black moonscape of today will be transformed into some green come spring. But it will take a long time, decades, if not centuries, for those thousands of trees reduced to black sticks to be replaced by new trees. Maybe at core, it's just too sad for us. What's not too sad is our new home located in Niwot. You know where that is. It's down in Boulder here. We moved in early December, and you know what? As we moved around the country a lot, just trying to keep ahead of the long arm of the law, moving was kind of complicated. Not this time. We threw everything we own in the back seat of our cars, and presto, we were moved. One trip, 15 minutes. Very, very sweet. So as I conclude here, in a perverse sort of way, it has been a very sweet experience. Family and friends have rushed to assist, to help, to comfort, to do anything. We got to hear lots of nice things that normally would only be said after you die, possibly. It's a great feeling, though, to know we are minuscule pawns in the ebb and flow and repetition of fire in the West. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Amy Millenor, and I'm here representing Chris Finn, who is my uncle and the head of the volunteer fire department in Gold Hill. The Gold Hill Inn was saved from the fire, which we're very grateful for. My grandparents opened the Gold Hill Inn in 1963, Chris's parents. And the poem I'm going to read you is a poem by Eugene Field that was the inspiration for my grandfather opening the inn. The Gold Hill Inn has served as a community center for Gold Hill and all the local communities there. And during the fire, it was actually the staging ground for the firefighters who were working to save Gold Hill. So I'm going to read Casey's Tobbled Oat by Eugene Field, and it's a poem that my grandfather recited often. Oh, them days on Red Hoss Mountain, when the skies was fair and blue, when the money flowed like liquor, and folks was brave and true, when the nights was crisp and balmy, and the camp was all astir, with the joints all throwed wide open, and no sheriff to demur. Oh, them times on Red Hoss Mountain, in the Rockies fur away, there's no sich place nor times like them as I can find today. What though the camp has busted, I seem to see it still, a lion like it loved it on that big and warty hill. And I feel a sort of yearning and a choking in my throat when I think of Red Hoss Mountain and of Casey's Tobbled Oat. While yes, it's true, I struck it rich, but that don't cut a show when one is old and feeble and it's nigh his time to go. The money that he's got in bonds or carries to invest don't figure with a codger who's lived a life out west. And us old chaps like to sit around, away from folks and noise, and think about the sights we seen and things we's done as boys. The which is why I love to sit and think of them old days, when all us western fellers got the Colorado craze. And that is why I love to sit around all day and gloat on thoughts of Red Hoss Mountain and of Casey's Table d'Hote. This Casey was an Irishman, you'd know it by his name, and by the facial features appertaining to the same. He'd lived in many places and had done a thousand things, from the noble art of acting to the work of dealing kings. But somehow hadn't caught on, so drifting with the rest, he drifted for a fortune to the undeveloped west. And he came to Red Hoss Mountain when the camp was new, when the money flowed like liquor and folks was brave and true. And having been a steward on a Mississippi boat, he opened up a cafe and he runned a Table d'Hote. The bar was long and rangy with a mirror on the shelf and a pistol so that Casey, when required, could help himself. Down underneath there was a row of bottled beer and wine and a keg of bourbon whiskey of the run of 59. Upon the walls was pictures of hosses and of girls, not much on dress, perhaps, but strong on records and on curls. The witch had been identified with Casey in the past, the hosses and the girls, I mean, and both was mighty fast. But all these fine attractions was a precious little note by the side of what was offered at Casey's Table d'Hote. There was a half a dozen tables altogether in the place, and the tax you had to pay upon your victuals was a case. The boarding houses in the camp protested 'twas a shame to patronize a robber, which this Casey was the same. They said a case was robbery to tax for airy meal, but the Casey tended strictly to his biz and let him squeal. And presently the boarding houses all began to bust, while Casey kept on sawing wood and laying in the dust. And once a traveling editor from Denver City wrote a piece back to his paper, puffin' Casey's Table d'Hote. A Table d'Hote is different from ordering a la carte. In one case, you get all there is, into other only part. And Casey's Table d'Hote began in French, as all begin. And Casey's ended with the same, which is to say, with vin. But in between was every kind of reptile, bird, and beast, the same like you can get in high-toned restaurants down east. And winding up was cake or pie with coffee demi-tasse, or sometimes floating Ireland with a soothing kind of sass that left a sort of pleasant tickling in a feller's throat and made him hanker after more of Casey's Table d'Hote. The very recollection of them puddings and them pies brings a yearning to my bosom and water to my eyes, and seems like cooking nowadays ain't what it used to be in camp on Red Hoss Mountain in that year of 63. But maybe it is better, and maybe I'm to blame. I'd like to be a living in the mountains just the same. I'd like to live that life again when skies was fair and blue, when things was run wide open and men was brave and true, when brawny arms the flinty ribs of Red Hoss Mountain smote, for wherewithal to pay the price of Casey's Table d'Hote. And you, O cherished brother, a-sleepin' way out west, with Red Hoss Mountain huggin' you close to its lovin' breast, O, do you dream in your last sleep of how we used to do, of how we worked our little claims together, me and you? Why, when I saw you last, a smile was restin' on your face, like you was glad to sleep forever in that lonely place. And so you was, and I'd be too if I was sleepin' so, but bein' how a brother's love ain't for the world to know. Whenever I've this heartache and this chokin' in my throat, I lay it all to thinkin' of Casey's Table d'Hote. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rod Moraga, and I'm a Logan Mill resident, lost our home there. I didn't write a intro. I'm thinking I should have, because that's about what I got right here. But I realized I have something to say about why I picked the book I picked. And the book I picked is called Fire, A Brief History by Stephen Pine. And he's a gentleman who really has always captured the same ideals that I have about fire. And the fire for me was a lot of things, but I have spent most of my career obsessed with fire. And anyone who knows me knows that I don't like digging line a lot. I'm not much for the work part of fire. But I will go to any fire. I enjoy watching fire. It's what I do. And I'm a fire behavior analyst, so my whole job is to try to understand fire. It's to try to predict it and try to figure out what it's going to do today, tomorrow, and the next day. You know, I kind of feel like I spent a lifetime being a proponent of fire, always defending fire. Many, many meetings that I have been to in this county to explain to people why we should go light their forest on fire on purpose, which was not always easy. And through all that, you know, I always felt that I had a kinship with fire. And I think what bugged me most about that day was that I felt kind of betrayed by the fire, because I felt, you know, we're pals. I've been doing this with you forever. And I was just shocked when the house burned down, because I felt like, wow, that's not how I thought this would play out at all. You know, somehow I would get a pass. And after the fire, I felt angry, and I couldn't figure out what it was that was bugging me, but I think I'm starting to put that together now, and I need to come back to the reason I love fire and why I do what I do. And so within that, is in this book, we're going to go all the way back to primordial here. So that's what I'm going to talk about here. Fire and earth, creating combustion. According to many myths, we became truly human only when we acquired fire. So it is natural to assume a parallel awakening for the place we live. Rather, the earth likely simmered through more than 4 billion years before its biotic broth boiled over. Some of fire's components, the ancient earth acquired only after long eons. Even more critically, those ingredients needed a durable context in which to mingle. The parts had to combine and do so consistently. Combustion has its creation story. Fire has its history. Of fire's three essential elements, only the heat of ignition thrived on the early earth. Oxygen did not begin to collect until the last 2 billion years and did not begin to approach modern quantities until roughly 500 million years ago. Land plants suitable to carry combustion did not become abundant until 400 million years ago. Before that time, the earth lacked the means to burn regularly or vigorously. It is possible that aquatic biomass might have burned if a lagoon or marsh dried or storms hurled kelp or algal mats into deep berms where they dried, met lightning or lava, and combusted. But such burns, if they occurred, would little resemble modern fires and are ecological freaks, never absorbed or ordered within a biological community. Earth's original fires, its colonizing fires, demanded land plants. Probably these consisted of primordial moors, a matrix of near-shore organic peat and reeds. Fires probably first flickered during the early Devonian, roughly 400 million years ago. The most ancient fossil charcoal dates from that epoch. Since then, fire's evolution has been unending, if uneven. Each of combustion's components has existed more or less distinctly from the others, colliding from time to time with a fizz of oxidation or a brilliant burst of burning. But combustion could survive only if it had a consistent and durable context. Over time, fire became itself a synthesizing process, a kind of biochemical flywheel that has helped to balance its separate parts into a coherent whole. It has affected the chemistry of the atmosphere. It has influenced, perhaps profoundly, the character of life. Progressively, the biosphere has absorbed fire and tweaked it to fit a system of biological checks and balances. This was easiest with oxygen and fuel, both the products of life. The absorption of ignition proved more vexing and had to await the arrival of creatures who could make sparks and heat as easily as they could drill bone and chip flint. Those creatures, of course, were ourselves. Thanks.
You're listening to highlights from Words to Stir the Soul and Reckon with Reality, an event that was held in Boulder last month to mark the 6-month anniversary of the 4 Mile Canyon fire. We'll hear more from the event after a break. This is Showcase on Colorado Public Radio. Welcome back to Showcase on Colorado Public Radio. I'm Dave Fender. Today, we're featuring highlights from Words to Stir the Soul and Reckon with Reality. The event was held last month on the campus of the University of Colorado in Boulder to mark the six-month anniversary of the Four Mile Canyon fire. A group of speakers were asked to select readings that reflect on some aspect of their experience with the fire. Some chose works from other authors, and some, like our next speaker, read something they wrote themselves.
Hi, I'm Andy O'Connor, and when I was 12 years old, my house burned down for the first time in Chicago, and my house burned down for the second time during the Four Mile Fire back in September. And it's really an honor to be here today to share with you some of the things I've written since then. I was gone when the fire started. I was in Port Townsend, Washington, kayaking, so I wasn't here to save anything. So everything that I owned was what was in the back of my car, which fortunately included my little dog, Nellie. But I had to drive home 1,500 miles after my house burned down with just what I owned in the car and the kayak on top of the car and the dog in the back. The day after the fire, I started writing emails to my friends and family to let them know I was okay, because somebody called me and said, "You're on the missing list with the sheriff." So I started writing emails to my friends and family to let them know I was okay, and also to let them know what I was thinking and feeling about the fire. And a lot of my friends are writers, and so I was sending these emails every couple of days. And after a couple of weeks, my friend said, "You should really publish these. You know, you should write a blog." And I was like, "No, I'm not a writer, and the world does not need another blog." But they persisted and convinced me. And so in October, I started a blog called Burning Down the House. It's okay to laugh at that title. And the subtitle is Essays on the Poetry of Loss. And 3 weeks after we started the blog, it was chosen the best personal blog of 2010 by Westword. And last week it was written up in the New York Times. So you never know where tragedy is going to take you. So that's kind of one of the themes of the blog. Tonight I'm going to read one of the letters I wrote to friends about 2 months after the fire. And it's called Lost and Found. November 7th, 2010, 2 months after the fire, Lost and Found. English map makers used to write, "Here there be dragons," on the blank places on their maps. If you sailed past this point, they said, you would end up in the teeth of the beast and never be heard from again. Dear friends, this morning I woke up early just as dawn was breaking and felt restless, like a pressure cooker with no release valve. I paced around, fretting and itchy, wondering what to do with myself. Low altitude sickness, I thought. I need to get back up the mountain. In the mountains, I had a way to let off the steam from my busy life. Each evening, I would go hiking with my dog, Nellie, on the little trail that went from my kitchen door up the side of the mountain to the old Dime Road. When we got to the top, I would take in the quiet, the aloneness, the peace and green. Nellie would explore the mountainside, wagging, and I would simply sit, letting go of the day. And I would hike down the mountain with Nellie, back to our warm and cozy home, to make dinner and watch the lights of Boulder come on and the stars come out as the day turned to night. We floated up there at 8,000 feet in our quiet and peaceful ship, like sailors in the clouds. But now our mountain and our meadow are gone, and will not come back in my lifetime. And most people don't understand this. Most of us hear about how the grass comes back so quickly after a wildfire and how fire is good for the land, but that's not the whole story. I was a park ranger for 8 years. I used to give talks on fire ecology, and I know that in a hot fire like this one, the land can be sterilized and it can be dead and lifeless for years. I drove through Yellowstone on my way home this summer and saw acres and acres of dead black trees. And it's been 22 years since that fire. It's good for the land, but how would you like to live in the middle of it for the rest of your life? The beauty of mountain life in this area was that you could live surrounded by pine forests and look at acres and acres of trees. And 6,000 acres of those trees are burned, charred, and scarred beyond recognition. 6,000 acres. The foothills and the canyons that were burned by the Four Mile Fire were a patchwork of private and public lands, and most of those acres will never be cleared. The grass will come back, but those ghostly, corpse-like trees will stand, a grim remembrance of this fire for the rest of my life. For 20 years, I floated in the clouds, but that ship has sailed. Nellie and I are on a new journey now, through strange and uncharted waters, and there is much to see along the way. There are islands of hope and friendship filled with interesting people and new experiences. There are incredible acts of kindness, gifts of food and clothing, and dog toys and good wishes. There are songs of hope sung in our ears, like siren songs that beckon us on. There is much that is lost and much that is found. May we all embrace what is lost and what is found. This is the dance of life, I think. Sometimes we decide to let go, to start a new life, to loosen our tethers and sail on into the unknown. And at other times, our moorings are cut in the night, slashed by the great hand of fate, and our little ship is pushed into the torrent, rudderless and spinning. But it all leads to the same place in the end, for this is the great adventure, after all, and if we are fearless, we may sail past the rocks and shoals and brooding islands, past the sign that says, "Here there be dragons," and find a new world. Wishing you a good night and smooth sailing, Andy.
Hi, I'm Joe Pelley. I'm the county sheriff in Boulder County, and county sheriffs in Colorado occupy an odd role. We are the fire wardens of the county. It's an awesome responsibility, and it has been a troubling responsibility the last couple of years, including this weekend. The fire warden is responsible for getting people out of harm's way. The fire warden, the sheriff, is responsible for mustering resources and helping the local fire districts when a fire grows beyond their capacity to control the fire, suppress the fire. As the sheriff, as the fire warden of the county, I'm often confronted with or by folks who don't necessarily understand the strength and the power, the awesome power of fire and wind. People who come from places where you call the fire department, they come put the fire out. And they don't understand why that didn't happen in some cases. I don't live well anymore with wind. I can tell you, we talk a lot about fire, but wind's my enemy. It keeps me awake at night and causes a lump in my throat and works on my ulcer. I had a full head of hair when I became sheriff 8 years ago, and the wind has worked it away. I also picked from Timothy Egan's book, The Big Burn, the story of the catastrophic fires in 1910, burnt 3.2 million acres. And I picked a part of this because, and it's not going to sound encouraging to you when I read it, but it's about wind and fire, and it's about the beginning of the most catastrophic fire in our history. And the reason I picked it is because along with being a sheriff and the fire warden and working with the firefighters, the fire districts, comes a sense of responsibility and sometimes guilt about not saving houses and not stopping fire and the loss. And this chapter reminded me of what the reality of what we're dealing with. And so I find some comfort in the fact that sometimes the best thing you can do is get people out of the way, and then work with the elements and work with the fire and work with the topography to stop it, because you're not going to stand in front of it. In the canyons of the Clearwater National Forest, the air climbs swiftly through the mountains. The big river that gave the forest its name, flat and glossy in the lazy part of the day, became white-capped and shaggy as the Pellucer raked over it. When it ran into the walls of an ancient rock, the wind compacted and accelerated, forcing its way upward, following the contours of the land, The racing wind hit the first fire in a mix of pine at lower elevation. The wind took the hot floor of simmering forest and threw it into the air, where it lit the boughs of bigger ponderosa and white pines, which snapped off and rode the force of the upward acceleration. Pine sap heated quickly and hissed as it reached a boiling point. Every headwall, every dead end of every canyon, every narrow valley served as a chimney, compressing the fire-laden air into funnels of flame. The chain reaction of wildfire had begun. Heated plant material released hydrogen and carbon while drawing in oxygen, and the whole of it was on the run, a weather system of its own. Thus, three small blazes in grass met six bigger ones in the lower forest and then merged with a dozen others before joining 20 or 30 more until the mass of it was bundled into a single wall of yellow and orange, moving upward at 50 miles an hour in the crowded zone of Douglas fir, spruce, and larch, into groves of wizened hardwoods and withered cedars next to dried up streams, moving faster than a horse can run. All at once, it burned at the scrub and the limbs in the lower tier of the forest. It burned at the thick mid-height. It burned large boughs, which broke away in the storm, huge cones popping into fireballs. It burned at the crowns, the highest tips of the trees exploding into the air, flying off to light the crowns of other tall trees. The densest part of the forest, between 3,000 and 5,000 feet, was ready to burn fiber when the flames moved through it. In pops and cracks and snaps and gulps, in gasps and whistles, the fire metastasized, more clamorous with every fresh intake, charging ahead. Any leftover little fire that might have smoldered and smoked in a last gasp was given new life by the wind. Yanked from the ground, pitched into a river of flame, into the current of the now unrecognizable Palouser. Midway through the clear water, the wall of flame took over the forest, hundreds of feet high, 30 miles wide, and still gaining strength, still fanning out, consuming oxygen in heaves and picking up intensity at its core temperature. The fire was a classic convection engine now, heat rising, pulling the hottest elements upward, a gyro of spark and flame. After racing through the clear water in the Nez Perce forest, leveling nearly all living things, the fire swept up trees at the highest elevations. At this altitude, along the spine of the Bitterroots, the wind moved without obstruction. The fire itself threw brands 10 miles or more ahead of the flame front. The storm found the Montana border and spit flames down into the heavily settled Bitterroot Valley. It found the low, low forest and crossed over the pass along the summits, jumping ridgeline to ridgeline. At the peak of its power, it found the Coeur d'Alene forest, leading with a punch of wind that knocked down thousands of trees before the flames took out the rest of the woods. By now, the conscripted air was no longer a palisure, but a firestorm of hurricane-force winds in excess of 80 miles an hour. It had been nearly 3,000 small fires through a three-state region burning north in the northern Rockies and had grown into a single large burn. During the Overland fire, I was in Jamestown and we were working on evacuations and moving people when I heard for the first time that jet engine roar. The jet engine roar of a fire creating its own weather system and its own wind and racing above us, sound I never want to hear again. This book reminds me of that, but it reminds me of the power of fire and wind, and hopefully by reading it, my hope is to help people understand what these firefighters face when they're called to try to douse a fire like this. Thank you very much.
Well, I feel like I just got blown up here. Thank you, Sheriff. Whew. I'm Tisha Connolly Schuler, and I live in 4 Mile in Wall Street. And I didn't lose my house. So you're probably wondering, yay. You're probably wondering, well, what's she doing up here? She must be some sort of outstanding citizen or something. But I'm here to tell you I'm not. I was actually a complete wreck during the fire, and that's what I'm going to tell you about. So 15 years ago, I bought a little log cabin in Wall Street, built in 1873 on the dark side. You don't know that when you buy it in the middle of the summer. You don't get any sun. Don't buy them on the dark side. And when I bought my cabin, I said, I'm going to leave this place, and it hurts. That's the plan. And then I met my husband, and if you've seen my husband, you'll know that he makes you rethink things. He's a good-looking man. So I married him, and we had two boys who were 3 and 7 at the time of the fire, and we really had to rethink this. Living in the mountains is hard. It's a lot of driving. We're on a dirt road. We don't have any sun for 2 months a year. Everything in our cabin is like this. This is a hardship. I commute to Denver. But we met Gold Hill School, a two-room schoolhouse up in Gold Hill, and we decided that we wanted to send our boys there. And so we adapted, and we said, okay, we're here. We're going to leave this house, and it hurts. We're here. And then the fire happened, and we were evacuated, and we were in town, and people told us that all of Wall Street had burned. And so we said, okay, we have each other. It's okay. But it really wasn't okay. It was like having the rug pulled out from you, and you find that you're in free fall. And when we were told the next day by my good friend Rod Moraga, who sent us a picture of our house on his iPhone, which I still have, thank you, technology, we knew our house was okay, but we stayed in free fall for weeks. And you know that if you've ever watched people suffer who you love, who've lost their houses, that it can be as exhausting and emotionally wrecking as going through some of these things yourself. So as we were evacuated and I was in this sense of just free fall, I thought, why do I wake early? So every morning I wake at 4:30 so I can have my time to myself, and then I go work out, and then I commute to Denver. And I said, why do I wake early? And I remembered to wake early one morning when we were evacuated. And it's because you can connect to this sense of wisdom and a sense of serenity that goes past this great illusion of permanence that we have that none of us really have. And so this poem is called Why I Wake Early. Hello, sun in my face. Hello, you who make the morning and spread it over the fields and into the faces of the tulips and the nodding morning glories and into the windows of even the miserable and the crotchety. Best preacher that ever was, dear star, that just happens to be where you are in the universe, to keep us from ever darkness, to ease us with warm touching, to hold us in the great hands of light. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Watch now how I start the day in happiness and kindness. Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Don Whittemore. I had the distinction, the honor, the dubious honor of being the incident commander on the 4 Mile Fire from about 1 o'clock on Monday the 6th through 6 p.m. on Tuesday the 7th. Mine was a singular experience in that my view and my outlook and my concerns at the end of the day were simply about the 200 firefighters we had on the line. I've had what I consider an adventurous lifestyle. I used to rock climb and ice climb, go on 2 to 3 week winter mountaineering trips, studied grizzly bears in Yellowstone, which if you're studying behavior of grizzly bears, it means that you're quiet in the woods and trying to not disturb them, which means you get a little closer sometimes because they don't know you're there as well. Rode out a hurricane in a 40-foot sailboat. On a fire in Nebraska 1 year, Rod and I rode out a fire in a house, only to have the house catch on fire around us. But I can tell you, I have never experienced fear until consider that the lives of 200 to 300 firefighters and uncountless number of people rest in your hands. I suddenly, for the first time, could connect with my father, who was a commanding officer of a destroyer during World War II. And I regretted that I could never share this connection with him, as he died 2 weeks after the fire before I could get back to him. It was both a fun and enormous challenge to try to figure out what to read today. I combed through my books, couldn't find anything, so I started researching. And I came across a out-of-print book published in 1948 called Fire. It was probably one of the first pieces of fiction that I could find about the subject of fire, written by George Stewart, generally a unremarkable or not well-known author, although he did write a book called Storm, which has the origins for how we now name hurricanes. In his book, Storm, again, a work of fiction, he starts naming storms, and that's how we now come Hurricane Katrina and Rita and so forth. But I liked this book for its simplicity and for the fact that in the 40 or 63 years since really we've had the formalization and militia-like organization to firefighting, some things haven't changed. As I said, the book's out of print. I had to order it online. I figured if I'm ordering an out-of-print book, I might as well order one through a dust jacket, so I paid the extra $13 from somebody selling one with a dust jacket. And the book arrived like this. I went, wow. In it was a $20 bill, which was the cost of the book. And this note says, "Sir, my dad was a fireman in Redondo Beach in the 50s and a crash firefighter at the El Toro Air Base in the 60s. Take your $20 back and buy donuts for the next shift." Much respect, Word Bank Frank. So there's something that seemed calling to me about this book. Seventh day. To the men on the line, the fire was red glare in the eyes and reaching flame, roar and crackle in the ears, choking in the throat, fierce heat on the face. The fire possessed them and beat in upon their senses. Yet actually, what was this thing called fire? Like a man, fire exists in time. First as a tiny spark, it lives faintly. A breath of wind might blow it out, some drops of water quench it. But if born in happy circumstances, it feeds lustily and grows. It takes shape and develops structure, drawing in fresh air along the ground, throwing off smoke and consumed air skywards. Where once it scarcely crept, now suddenly it walks and runs. The vigor and power of youth rises within it. It grows adult and casts out sparks and kindle new fires. Yet even as it sweeps ahead in power and glory, the shadow lies over it. This too shall pass away. Failing to find food, rained upon, blown against by contrary winds, the fire loses vigor. Grown weaker, it searches less strongly for food, and so grows weaker still. It lies in the quiet of old age, and at last, quickly or slowly, it dies. The likeness to man does not fully hold. Now a fire is more like a shape-shifting monster, stretching out long and encircling arms before it. Now a fire is like a nation, growing weak for a while, and then springing up with new vigor as millions of flamelets within it die, or as new flamelets blaze up. But man, or monster, or nation, like them all, the fire is a thing in and of itself. It begins and is and ends. It is born and lives and dies. Last day. The men on the line, as the hours passed, had thought of fire only as an enemy. Evil, malignant, and scheming, it came against them. They stood and fought and fell back and stood again and fought and in weariness and in danger and in terror, they hated fire. Yet all the while, fire was good. As a friend, it worked for them. Fire lent its heat to the coffee that lifted their hearts in the morning chill. Fire sent forward the supply trucks and powered the crashing bulldozers and sustained the scouting planes. The smoldering fire of cigarettes gave comfort in the breathing spells. In the piercing cold of the mountain nights, the men warmed themselves at the glowing logs. And when the right moment came, the backfire was their best ally. So from ancient past, fire has been at once comforter but mischief maker, blessed but baleful, preserver of life but its destroyer, purifier but annihilator. It gives and it takes away. Yet in the end, all this good and bad was only in the mind of man. The fire, like a storm or a river or a star or sun, felt neither love nor hate, knew neither good nor bad. The fire burned and made no judgments.
You've been listening to selections from Words to Stir the Soul and Reckon with Reality, perspectives on the six-month anniversary of the Four Mile Canyon Fire. The event was held last month and was sponsored by the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado in Boulder. For a listing of all the speakers and readings heard in this program, go to our website at cpr.org. We also have a link to a podcast recording of the entire event, which includes speakers and readings that we were not able to include due to time constraints. We'd like to thank Patty Limerick, Amanda Hardman, Honey Lindberg, and the rest of the staff at the Center of the American West for their kind assistance during the event. Mark Coulter helped with the production of the show. I'm Dave Fender, and this is Showcase on Colorado Public Radio.